folks. Welcome to the January 9th, 2000 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM Radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide live at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here do not represent those of WEFT, its board director, station manager, or anybody else in a position of authority here at WEFT. They're solely our views. Now, here's Tom with some acknowledgments of some of our underwriters.
The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice. Building coalitions amongst workers, unions, and the community, the Illinois Education Association and the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice are proud to support WEFT Community Radio in East Central Illinois. This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A Democratic Union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the program, this week's edition of the Labor Hour Cultural Corner, Tom's brand new poem for this week, first heard live here on WFT, is entitled March by the Millions. Also here with us today is Bob Pelesny, our technical expert and advisor, who have some news and banner for us. And also here with us is co-founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. And now here's Tom with some workers' interest news headlines.
The number of people preparing to buy a home fell sharply in November, an unsettling new sign that the housing market may be headed for a double-dip downturn over the winter. Last week's figures came after a similarly discouraging report on new home sales, illustrating how heavily the housing market is depending presently on government help. In October, buyers raced to get contracts signed in time to take advantage of a tax credit for first-time homeowners that was set to expire. The tax credit is worth up to $8,000 for first-time home buyers and was initially set to expire November 30th, but Congress extended it through the end of this April and broadened it to include a credit of up to $6,500 for buyers who relocate. The National Association of Realtors reported its seasonally adjusted index of sales contracts fell 16% from October to November, ending 9 months of gains. Economists surveyed by Thomson Reuters had expected only a 2% drop. When the tax credit expires this spring and the government phases out programs to keep mortgage rates low, the housing market will have to stand on its own, but many economists are doubting that it can. Bob?
Okay, nearly 1,000 hotel workers and supporters converged on the posh downtown San Francisco Hilton on January 5th, opening a new front in Unite Here's Local 2's months-long contract battle. Hundreds of students, community organizers, and workers from other unions joined them on boisterous pickets. Union President John Wilhelm and AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka were among the 130 protesters arrested at a civil disobedience action in front of the Hilton, Unite Here's newest boycott target. Separate contract talks with each of the 61 city hotels are at a standstill over health care benefits and workload despite months of union pressure, including a boycott at 5 hotels, civil disobedience actions, and weeks of rolling strikes at 3 hotels. The corporations will not budge until they feel it in their pocketbooks, said Riddhi Mehta, spokeswoman for Local 2. They think they have nothing to lose, but they are mistaken because guests are not getting quality service. Facing a hotel industry that registered more than $200 billion in profits in the last decade, Local 2 upped the ante again. Demonstrators marched from Grant Avenue to a picket line in front of the Hilton demanding a contract before leaders and rank-and-file activists blocked the Hilton's main entrance and were arrested. The hotel chain wants to cut pay for new hires by 25% and shift an increasing portion of health care costs onto all workers in each year of the contract. The union reports several chains are demanding costs for workers rise from $35 a month to $200 a month in the third and final year of their offer. San Francisco hotel workers make $30,000 a year on average, the union says. Meanwhile, the CEO of Blackstone Group, which owns Hilton, earned more than $1 billion in 2008.
Those greedy union workers, I mean, don't they know this is going to cut into Paris Hilton's monthly allowance?
Exactly.
I mean, they are just so inconsiderate. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's a good thing they built that one in town here, non-union, too.
Yeah, well, yes. We got some... Bill and I both have some real gripes about how the billing trades handled that. They definitely did not fight back like they should have, and they could have won that one. That was an easy one, and they let it go. Anyway, that's another topic for another show. Maybe we can get somebody from the billing trades on the show. You think they might take up our gauntlet? Are you kidding? Yeah. Anyway, tens of thousands of fired Mexican electrical utility workers have been banned from finding work. Their jobs were terminated by the government of President Felipe Calderon on October 11th when it shut down Central Power and Light, the electrical utility that provided Mexico City and central Mexico with power. It's the initials LYFC was closed in a military operation when at midnight October 11th over 6,000 Mexican military troops surrounded the company's headquarters and plants and expelled the workers. An article published on December 28th in the Mexican daily La Jornada quoted Eduardo Cortez Carrasco, a sacked worker with 19-year seniority as a white-collar employee. He's quoted as saying, "It is a veritable witch hunt," declared Cortez. "We are denied jobs wherever we go." Initially, Cortez had accepted a government severance package and up to now had not participated in the conflict between the electric utility workers and the Mexican government. He has now joined the SME campaign to reopen the LYFC. Now, that's privatization at gunpoint, literally. Unbelievable.
According to a new survey, only 45% of Americans are satisfied with their work. Even Americans who are lucky enough to have work in this stagnant economy are becoming more and more unhappy with their positions. That 45% was the lowest level ever recorded by the Conference Board Research Group in over 22 years of studying the issue. The demise of worker satisfaction can be in large part blamed on the worst recession since the 1930s, which is making it difficult for many to find suitable employment. Workers' unhappiness can be blamed on a variety of reasons, such as fewer workers consider their jobs to be interesting, incomes have not kept up with inflation, and the soaring costs of health care have greatly diminished workers' take-home pay. Economists say if the trend is not reversed, it could stifle innovation and hurt America's productivity, and it could make unhappy older workers less inclined to share their knowledge and skills with younger workers.
Neil Parthen, co-host of Not Another Sports Show on 104.5 FM.
That's at 2 o'clock on Saturdays?
That's right. Here mm-hmm. It's actually in Urbana from the Independent Media Center. Anyway, he reports that Major League Baseball umpires have negotiated a five-year labor contract to extend through 2014. The previous bargaining agreement was going to expire December 31st, 2009. The umpires' relationship with management has mirrored that of the players, leading to work stoppages in 1970, 1978, 1979, 1984, 1990, 1991, and 1995. They also had a failed mass resignation plan in 1999, which caused them to switch unions that have now negotiated a pair of contracts. Oh, and by the way, podcasts for Not Another Sports Show are available in the iTunes store. Just search for Not Another Sports Show.
Okay. In Detroit, auto workers, retirees, and supporters will gather in front of this year's Detroit Auto Show on January 11th to make clear the notion of a jobless recovery is no recovery at all in a state with the highest unemployment rate in the nation, officially at 14.7%. They will not be alone. Nearby, at General Motors headquarters in downtown Detroit, right-wing teabaggers will be staging a rally against government Motors to protest against the government takeover of America. Since the Wall Street meltdown in late 2008, auto sales plummeted from more than $16 million a year to close to $10 million, with no predictions of a comeback anytime soon. The billions of dollars loaned to two of the big three as part of their bankruptcy proceedings in early 2009 only temporarily kept GM and Chrysler above water, while resulting in new rounds of plant closings, layoffs, and severe contractual takeaways from unionized workers, including freezing pay at $14 an hour for junior workers. Monday's auto workers' rally will argue the government is letting an enormous opportunity go to waste. The rally will demand that the Obama government use its 60% stake in General Motors and 10% at Chrysler to direct a rapid conversion of idled and to-be-idled facilities to produce green technologies and rehire the many unemployed workers in the region. At the auto worker rally, organizers like UAW American Axle retiree Wendy Thompson will call for a conversion that takes us away from an economy based on non-renewable fossil fuels, which is critical to tackling the other crisis that is looming on the horizon, global warming. And Diane Feely, another UAW retiree from American Axle, said the plants could be refitted to produce wind and water turbines and solar panels for clean energy and components for public transit systems, including buses, light rail, and high-speed rail, helping reduce the carbon emissions that are throwing the planet's climate dangerously out of balance. Axle plants would be particularly good for producing wind turbines, Feely noted. And in the meantime, the teabaggers will be giving lip service to the good folks of Michigan who need jobs, all the while berating the Obama administration for preventing the total collapse of GM and Chrysler. While the extreme right thinks the government did too much, Thompson said, auto workers think so far it has done too little.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And, you know, these are some great ideas. Unfortunately, yes. the Obama administration is not going to do it because they'll make the oil industry angry.
Right.
I mean, and this is the thing, is like was pointed out early the previous program, News from Neptune, by Doug Henward's economic report, is that what's characterized the Obama administration so far is that they basically not only are propping up the corporate status quo, but they'll go out of their way not to have any conflict with corporate interests. I mean, look at this whole thing with the insurance industry, you know, trying to get some supposedly a health care reform bill, which ended up being a giveaway to the insurance companies. You telling me the president of the United States, the most powerful person in the world, can't take on one corporate industry? Give me a break. And in conjunction with that, the U.S. media, corporate media, has been virtually silent on the colossal year-end bonuses by 2009 that will shortly be handed out to major American banks and financial firms. This is a doubtless deliberate response by the corporate-controlled media to popular anger over the financial gains reported by Wall Street executives who have been bailed out at the taxpayer expense, while working people have been left to face depression, levels of unemployment, and mounting home foreclosure, hunger, and poverty. A brief article published on the inside pages of the business section of the January 1st New York Times, with bigger bonuses and upside for banks, notes in passing that the three top Wall Street banks will pay out an estimated $49.5 billion in cash bonuses and stock awards. Those banks are Goldman Sachs, again, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Morgan Stanley. All received a combined $45 billion in cash under the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP, passed by Congress in October of 2008 over the objections of 99% of their constituents, I might add. Along with the rest of the banks, they have benefited from trillions of dollars in nearly interest-free loans, debt guarantees, security purchases, and other subsidies from the Treasury and the Federal Reserve Board. The government has further underwritten bank profits and surging bonuses by keeping interest rates at near zero and pumping trillions of dollars of cheap credit into the financial markets while placing no restrictions whatsoever ever on the ability of the banks to resume the speculative practices that participated in the financial crisis of 2008. Meanwhile, the American people have lost $1.1 trillion in wealth, primarily through the collapse of home values. For their part, the banks have sharply curtailed lending over the past 15 months, draining more than $3 trillion of credit from the economy.
By the way, my Facebook friend Lisa Barr has been reporting over the last couple of weeks about fracking going on in rural New York State, and that is fracturing so that they can get, I think it's oil coming out of the ground, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that is very, very bad thing because it really messes up water supplies, aquifers. Well, one other problem with this is that all of the workers doing this are from outside the area. They're all being brought in. I asked her last night about what about the local unions, and it's a totally non-union job.
Oh, here we go again. This is the grand plan they have for the future. It's not going to be green jobs with union pay and benefits. It's going to be non-green jobs, or what few green jobs there are. And it's going to, the whole agenda is to have them non-union, low-paid. We're going back to the 1920s, ladies and gentlemen. So we got to fight back. But anyway.
Facing unrelenting criticism over violent inmates who were secretly set free after only weeks behind bars, Governor Pat Quinn suspended a second early release program for state prisoners last Tuesday. The newly halted plan had been announced in September as a way to cut costs and jobs. It is separate from a secret release program known as MGT Push that Quinn ended after it came to light last month. The Illinois Correction Department confirmed Tuesday night that Quinn stopped the publicized program until he can name a public safety officer to review it. It was intended to send home 1,000 allegedly nonviolent offenders early and having them finishing their sentences on electronic detention. However, the truth of the matter is a large percentage of felons already released were violent offenders, and a large number of those are already back behind bars. In other words, if Quinn has his way, a criminal in Illinois can assault or rob or rape or kill you and face a matter of weeks in jail. But don't get caught with a joint in your pocket or you'll do years.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's just unbelievable. But so is a lot of the news these days. Bob?
Yeah, locally here, stories out of the News Gazette this week. University of Illinois employees weren't shocked at the news of furloughs on Tuesday, and some expect things to get worse before they get better. The furlough program announced Tuesday will save only about $17 million despite a $436 million shortfall from the state. Other cuts will have to come from salary and hiring freezes and potentially job cuts. Under the furlough plan, the highest-ranking employees will take 10 days off, while those making under $30,000, contract employees and graduate employees, will be exempt. Other savings will come from a salary and hiring freeze, though Stanley Eikenberry said exceptions could be made in the case of a raid on faculty from other universities or a clearly unfair salary. And more news coming out on Saturday here. The U of I says it is willing to consider unpaid furloughs for several thousand civil service workers to prevent layoffs, Interim President Stanley Eikenberry said. The school would like to reach a cordial agreement with unions that represent civil service workers on a furlough plan like the one announced Tuesday for other employees. That would avoid layoffs, at least insofar as it relates to this immediate situation. And that pretty much wraps that up.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob. And we're going to hear a little bit of Ann Feeney, and we're going to come right back with Tom Thomas's poem of the week.
I guess you've been around since the dawn of time, you damn goonies. Did you ooze right out of the primordial slime, you goonies? With possums and some robbed graves. You slept with your sisters and sold them for slaves, you goonies. Damn goonies. Now when workers are tossed out on the street, you'll find goonies. You come swarming like maggots on putrid meat, goonies. Kin to jackals, hyenas, leeches, and skunks. Go back to dog-kicking, wife-beating, and rolling drunks. Whacking Hut Pinkerton, thugs and punks, goonies. No brain, no heart, no balls, no spine. Get your rocks off, hassle in a picket line. You got them long-lens cameras and great big sticks. You don't need Viagra cause you got no girlfriends.
And now to that segment of the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Illinois World Labor Hour Cultural Corner with Tom Thomas and his poem this week, March by the Millions.
All he wanted was a good job to buy his family their food. and pay their rent and other bills and have some extra if he could. All he got was a pack of lies from the company he worked for, and when the truth he realized, the bosses kicked him out the door. Once he had the warmth of a home that he could dwell in happily, until the greedy bankers came and dealt with him deceitfully. Now he is living in the street. His children cannot go to school. His aching heart is filled with tears for having been treated so cruel. He searches for work from Miami to New York and Chicago too, and Denver and Los Angeles, but just can't get on any crew. The government still bleeds him dry, although he lives on charity. And though tax time has come around, he knows he'll see no parity. He is numbered by the millions in our land of opportunity. He has had to learn the hard way that there is no immunity. If you are not already rich, the chances are you'll never be, unless we march by the millions and demand that justice we see. Justice in every workplace. Take from the rich, give to the poor. Socialize the American dream, or it won't be here anymore. March by the Millions was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 8, 2010, and was first recited live January 9, 2010 on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, I've got a public service announcement here. You can celebrate the beginning of 2010 with the people who bring you independent media, the Public Eye and WRFU. Low Power FM 104.5 in Urbana, have a potluck fundraiser January 25th, 2010 at the Clark Bar. That's at 207 West Clark Street in Champaign, 6 to 9 p.m. There's a small suggested donation at the door, and you ask to bring a dish to share, and that's from the folks who bring you independent media, the Public Eye, and WRFU, Low Power 104.5 FM in Urbana. January 25th. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, by the way, I just wanted to mention I've been to the Clark Bar a few times to see Road Song, and it's a really nice place to go. There's big fluffy couches, and they got some pretty good food there too, as well as a wonderful selection of beers.
Excellent.
Okay, Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. This Sunday, Considering Democracy, a film about what other advanced industrialized countries in the world are compared to the United States and the questions they pose. Why is it we don't have paid vacation in the United States while 30 other countries in the world do? Why is it we don't have a national public health care plan that covers every citizen from the time they're born until the time they die when over 50 countries in the world do? Many of them are not advanced industrialized countries. And it poses a lot of other questions and also answers some of those questions about how our democracy, our supposed democracy, is compromised by corporate campaign money and influence. So tune in tomorrow, 4 o'clock, and see Labor's View TV and watch Considering Democracy.
And I'd like to thank Joe Futrell. He's a local activist by commenting on us on Facebook, saying nothing specific except that the Illinois World Labor Hour rocks.
Okay.
Rocks was in all caps.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
And Joe's involved with the local Prairie Green Party. We need to get Joe and some other people from the Prairie Greens back on the air here because we're getting ready to come into election season. But anyway, our guest is calling in right now on the show. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, David. This is Chuck Kelly.
Hi, Chuck. This is the Illinois World Labor Hour. Thanks for calling in. Listeners, we have Dr. Charles M. Kelly on the phone, and he's our guest today that's calling in. And Chuck has just written a book called Farewell to Fantasyland, Time for Economic and Political Reality. And he's written some other books, too. He's written The Destructive Achiever, Power and Ethics in the American Corporation back in 1988. He also wrote The Great Limbaugh Con, another right-wing assaults on common sense, which I had the pleasure of reading several years ago, which I thought was very informative. And also Class War in America, How Economic and Political Conservatives Are Exploiting Low and Middle Income Americans. Well, Chuck, again, thanks for calling in. And let's just start out. Could you give us a little background on yourself?
Well, I think my main background is that I've been a subscriber to the Wall Street Journal and Forbes and Fortune and Barron's and Business Week for about the last 35 years.
Okay.
And I've been able to look at their news reports and look at their op-eds and listen to what their editors say on radio and television, and I've noticed a huge discrepancy between the kinds of economic policies that they recommend to the public and the kinds of advice that they give to their investors. It's quite different. And it's obvious that they're deliberately pursuing policies that benefit America's investors and Wall Street at the direct expense of people who work for a living.
Okay.
And, I just felt qualified to write a book to present my analysis of what these people are doing.
Okay. Now, you didn't you work in the corporate world for a while?
Yeah, I was a management consultant for that 35-year period, and I was also a college professor.
Okay.
And my specialty was management and communication. And so I do have a background in argument and persuasion, and I can look at demagoguery and figure out what people are saying that is deceptive to the American public, and I can report on that.
Okay. Did you work a lot with the team concept and practices in the corporate world?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of team building.
Okay.
And one of my frustrations with management consulting is it's going from team building to cost reduction.
Okay.
And they're more interested in outsourcing and getting rid of people than they are in building teams these days.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, when they came out with the whole team programs back, oh, God, it must have been 30 years ago, right, or so. You know, this was supposed to be the end of, class conflict in America and a whole new era of, labor management cooperation. But it doesn't seem like it turned out that way.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it goes way back more like 70 years.
70, okay.
People started building teams. And it grew up until about 1970 or 1960. And then suddenly consultants started figuring out that they could make companies a lot more profitable through cost reduction and through building teams.
Okay.
And various business schools started teaching courses in power as opposed to team building and using power to get what you want out of people. And it became a more ruthless environment, in my opinion.
Okay. Your first book you wrote, The Destructive Achiever, it's sort of the synopsis of it is a major cause of organizational degeneration as organizations, corporations, unions, religions, nations, armies, etc. grow older, bigger, and more complex. Destructive achievers gain a competitive advantage over genuine leaders. What motivated you to write that book, Chuck?
Well, as I said, I was disgusted with the direction that I saw corporate management going in.
Mm-hmm.
Not only corporate management, but the business schools and management consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole emphasis was on the bottom line as opposed to building long-term corporations that benefit society in the long term.
Okay. So this wasn't about corporate practices. This also was like corporate culture had begun to change as well.
Yeah, corporate culture, corporate philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and the personal motivations of the people who rise to the top in these corporations. People who learn how to master the political system can have a tremendous promotional advantage over people who are simply trying to do a good job.
Oh,
boy. Because they're willing to take short-term shortcuts to maximizing profits that are actually to the company's detriment. I mean, Anderson Consulting is a classic example of it. When they went from being genuine accountants to trying to show corporations how they could camouflage bad news in their reports, they brought about their own demise.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. And then your next book, which I had the pleasure of reading, but I have to admit it's been about 7, 8 years ago, The Great Limbaugh Con. And I remember when I was reading this book, it was me talking a lot about how, of course, Rush Limbaugh and a lot of the other right-wing hate radio people try to talk like they're one of the average people and that they're basically advocating for the average person. But it's just, as you point out in the book, this is it's just the total opposite of that. My memory doesn't serve me real well about some of these techniques. Could you maybe elaborate on just one that Limbaugh and some of these other people use to convince working people to vote against their own best interests?
Well, one of the main things they do is called inoculation.
Inoculation, yes.
And that's where they accuse your opponents of doing exactly what you're doing.
Okay.
And he and other right-wing demagogues have become masters at that.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the one issue that is most evident is this whole issue of class warfare.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask the average person out there who's conducting class warfare, they'd say it's Democrat.
Oh, really?
You know, trying to make voters envious of the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats could have, if they'd be willing to take up the issue, and they don't seem to be willing to do it, most of them,
mm-hmm.
They could point out, hey, you know, the people who are really waging class warfare are the Republicans.
Yep.
And all you got to do is look at their legislation, and you can tell what they're doing. But then you got to stand back and take the attacks of the right-wing demagogues, who just say you're trying to make people envious of the rich, and you're penalizing success. And they've become very good at using terms that appeal to the public, but that distract the public from the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hi. I'm a co-host. My name's Bill Gorell. And, in this class war, too, it does seem like the other side is winning.
Uh-huh.
And they're taking no quarter, either, and taking no prisoners.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're winning, and one of the reasons is because of what a lot of Democrats have done. Ever since the early 1990s, Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council decided the only way a Democrat or a liberal was going to win an election was to act more like a Republican. And, of course, that led, among other things, to the adoption of NAFTA, and globalization, which was a Republican position. And so as soon as you have a Democrat like Clinton saying that globalization is a good idea, well, he gives credence to this economic myth that simply isn't true. And there were all kinds of people who were against globalization prior to Clinton coming out for it. But when he did it, that gave commentators and interviewers on radio and television the opportunity to say, well, it's not only a Republican issue, but Democrats support it too. It must be good. And that's when the American opinion began to shift in favor of unrestricted foreign trade, which is a disaster for working Americans.
Okay, so what do you think of President Obama so far? You make a prediction in your book, Farewell Fantasyland, that Obama will try to do all the right things, but America's wealthy and powerful will try to make sure that Congress will not let him take steps strong enough to make much of a difference. And he fails in his first term because of inadequate changes in tax and fiscal policies. Conservatives who insisted that the changes be inadequate will blame him for a terrible economy, which is actually caused by their own fiscal policies from 1980. To 2008. Just in general, what do you think of President Obama so far?
A big disappointment. I voted to him with enthusiasm, and he kind of reminded me of something I heard said about lawyers. I don't know who said it now, but they said that excellent lawyers, excellent advocates sometimes make poor judges.
Mm-hmm.
They're two different skills. And I think Obama's an excellent advocate, and when he was running for president, he was saying all the right things.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid once he became president, he was too vulnerable because of his lack of experience to the predominant opinions of mainstream Democrats who have adopted this philosophy that you can't win elections unless you become more like Republican life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, he was unwilling to go for the policies that he should have been advocating for, like single-payer health insurance. And he toned everything down, and as a result, he's getting much less than what he strived for. And not only that, he's added credibility to the conservative ideologies and philosophies about government and economics that are detrimental to us.
Mm-hmm.
Even Obama said he's not going to raise taxes on the wealthy. Well, not as much as he should, at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about the same kinds of policies that immediately benefit the banks and the financial industry and corporations, but do very little to increase the purchasing power of middle and low-income consumers. And the problem we have in the economy today there's not a lack of money in the hands of investors. I mean, there's tons of money there. And if you watch CNBC or Fox Financial Network, you'll find out that they're saying that the reason the stock market's been soaring over the past 6 months is because people have so much money. So the problem isn't investors not having enough money to invest. The problem is consumers don't have enough money to buy products.
Mm-hmm.
And you couple that with the fact that investors are now putting their money in China. Well, in fact, they call it the BRIC nations. It's Brazil, India, China, and Canada, and you could also throw in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where investment money is going these days. That's where I would say the consensus of investment opinion is in along those lines.
Okay.
And they're saying if you are going to invest in an American corporation, you better invest in one that has presence in those other countries, because that's where the economic growth of the future is. And the reason the growth of the future is there is because that's where the industry is now.
Mm-hmm.
And we've given up our industry.
Yes, it's like a self-fulfilled prophecy in a way.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and in my opinion, conservatives are getting basically what they wanted, which was stagnant wages.
Mm-hmm.
And wages have been stagnating since 1980, and that's exactly what they wanted, but I'm not sure they realize how that's going to hurt them significantly in the near future.
Oh, indeed. You kind of went from a political to economic aspects here, and I know they both go back and forth. But going back to Obama and his disappointment, which we all share that with you, of course, here, all four of us co-hosts for sure in this room. In fact, we maybe even take it another step and say betrayal. But nevertheless, you know, this is, of course, bigger than one man. And even though the President of the United States is the most powerful person in the world, which, of course, you have to ask yourself, the most powerful person in the world can't take on one corporate industry like the health insurance industry. But my question is, how much do you think corporate money, corporate lobbying, and the whole government corporate revolving door have to do with the lack of promises being kept by the Obama administration and our government in general?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. Mm-hmm. When you look at the contributions that have been given to members of his own advisors and like Gaitner's previous association and what he did in the initial stages of the bailout, which is just now coming to into the news.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much cross-pollination between politics and economics now that it's hard to get rid of it. But
mm-hmm.
certainly the lobbyists are right in there causing our problem.
Yeah,
and the money that they can throw around.
I mean, it's almost like we got a system of legalized bribery in this country. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, yeah, and not only that, all that money gives them tremendous advertising power.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the unfortunate things is today, probably most voters don't read serious books about economics or politics. And most voters get their information from radio and television in the form of brief sound bites.
Unfortunately, that's corporate radio and television, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I stand corrected.
Yeah. So now, in your book, you talk about, you compare, like, Farewell Fantasyland, about how, you know, the corporate interests are always talking about that, you know, they go back and try to, of course, revise history and stuff. And they try to make the claim that Franklin Roosevelt's policies during the Great Depression, during the 1930s, actually did not bring the country out of the Depression and stuff. And you counter with some really good points here. And, I mean, in general, what you're saying is that in order for capitalism to work, that you need, and real free markets, free enterprise to work, that you need government involvement and regulation.
Yeah, it's absolutely necessary. Because without government regulation, capitalism can't work as it's intended to.
Mm-hmm.
Without appropriate actions by government, capitalism always self-destructs.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it in 1929, and we're seeing it today.
Mm-hmm.
And because the reason conservatives hate regulation is because regulations are what protect the educated or the uneducated from the educated.
Mm-hmm.
and the poor from the wealthy and the powerless from the powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have government, you've got no protection. And when I say educated versus uneducated, I'm talking about education in a relative term, because a lot of people who fell for these derivatives were pension fund managers who had PhDs in finance. And they were less well-educated than the people who were selling them. And when you take some people who study a particular market in great depth, if you don't have good people to defend against those people, they can bring about great havoc to an economy, and they can make tons of money for themselves in the process.
Yeah. Of course, you write very highly of FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But, I mean, there's some people out there that say that FDR wouldn't have done what he had done if it wasn't for the fact that the country was on the verge of a revolution, and that the fact that he was actually the person who really saved capitalism from itself and from a revolution happening in this country in the 1930s. Would you agree with that, or...?
Partially. Mm-hmm. I think what you said is basically correct. However, I think Roosevelt did want to do what was necessary. I just got through going through a book, with Franklin Roosevelt, Traitor to His Class, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And when he went through physical therapy for his paralysis, he gained a whole new appreciation for the problems that poor people were having. But he didn't feel that he could bring about the changes in economic policy because there wasn't enough support in the general public. And so he told many people that, I want to do what you want me to do, but you've got to make me do it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you've got to get out there and get the public riled up so that I have to do what you recommend.
Yeah.
In other words, he felt that he couldn't do anything without public support. I think that's what Obama's feeling right now also.
Yeah, in fact, Obama made that statement, if I'm not mistaken, on election night in Grant Park in Chicago. But what we've been seeing with Obama is that he's not listening. And not only is he not listening, he's blocking people from getting access to both the White House and the media.
Well, Dave, I want to jump in on this, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that... there has been some sort of summit meetings with labor leaders, such as including Richard Trumka and so mm-hmm. on. But what he's really talking about is we need busloads of people.
Okay.
We need a million unemployed worker march on Washington to show the right wing that Obama needs to cater to us.
Yeah, and Obama needs to listen to us, too, in my opinion, And, I love your book, Chuck. It's, I've given it to my 14-year-old daughter who's just started freshman in high school this year. And, of course, when I looked at her economics and business text, of course, the publishers of it are Standard & Poor's and the Wall Street Journal. So that pretty much tells
yeah.
you everything. And this book is just great because it's relatively short. I mean, it's about a little over 100 pages. And it's filled with great illustrations and graphs and photographs, and it really makes it a pleasure to read, and especially for like somebody who's a teenager. I mean, because teenagers, you know how they are. You know, they just don't really want to read much. You know, if it's anything too long, too serious,
at that
or whatever.
Age, they have the wandering minds.
But I don't want to imply that it's dumbed down whatsoever, because I mean, this is just incredible information here that you have, and I just want to really compliment you on it. I really recommend this book to anybody. And how can somebody get a copy of Farewell to Fantasyland?
Well, it's available on Amazon.com.
Okay.
And I deliberately tried to keep the price as low as I could. It's $10.99 there. But if you go to my website on farewellfantasyland.com, you can get a 20% discount on that.
Okay.
It'll give you a code, and you just go to the buy book link, and it gives you a code, and you can order it, and you can get 20% off of the $11 for the book.
Okay. And what's your website?
It's farewellfantasyland.com.
Okay. Very good.
And that's all one word, and it's Farewell.
Okay.
Fantasyland.
By the way, Charles, are you on Facebook?
No, I'm not. I should be, but I'm not. I'm not very technically sophisticated, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, there's two people with your name on there that I found.
Okay. Yeah, and I want to definitely thank our mutual friend Mike Griffin for recommending you and your book and everything. I guess he made your acquaintance quite a few years ago. And one last thing, one last question I want to ask you before we go is, what do you think, since how should I put it? Since we're kind of at a pestle, if you will, here on in economic and political situation here, both in this country and the world, what are your thoughts on worker-owned cooperatives?
I'm not sure. I frankly don't know enough about the subject to give you an intelligent answer.
Okay, because there's some people, of course, that think that considering everything that's happened, why do we need capitalists? I mean, in the sense that it's workers who make the product, it's workers who run a business, and that's everyone from, let's say, in an auto industry, from the assembly line worker to the person in engineering, research and development, to the designers, to the even the people who do the paper shuffling, and really.
Well,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me say this. It all sounds like a good idea to me,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the answer, because they still have to compete with working people in China who are making one-tenth as much.
Okay.
And until we address that issue, all the actions we take just on this side of the border aren't going to have that much, aren't going to give us much job security,
mm-hmm.
and especially the kinds of jobs that will pay decent income.
Okay, so you're saying that this would have to be on a worldwide level for it to work. It couldn't just happen in one country?
As long as labor is one-tenth what it is in this country, nothing in particular is going to work.
Okay, and real quick.
And somebody just sent me a book. They went to my website and thought I might like it. It's Free Trade Doesn't Work, Why America Needs a Tariff by Ian Fletcher.
Okay, so that's I was just going to ask you the next question is what in your opinion needs to happen here in order to prove get the living standard of the American worker back up to where it should be?
Well, I think tariffs are one answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the thing that's significant about this book that was just sent to me, the guy's in a think tank, a conservative think tank that represents the interests of small businesses and corporations. And he points out that America became great in a period when we had tariffs on goods coming from low-wage countries.
Okay.
And not only did it enable us to become a world leader, but throughout history that's been the case there.
Yeah, and
countries that
mm-hmm.
Well, countries that let their industry be vulnerable to cheap labor in other countries always decline.
Yeah, I majored in economics in college, and I remember, of course, one of the big things they preached and preached and preached was that that the reason the Great Depression happened was because of the Smoot Hawley Act, I think it was.
Hawley,
yep. Yes. Yep. And what's the validity of that in your opinion? Do you think that's accurate or not?
It's half accurate.
Half accurate. Okay.
And a half truth is the same as a lie.
Yes.
The inaccuracy of it is that the act was the result of the cause of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
The cause of the Depression were the policies of the 20s,
mm-hmm.
in which the number of millionaires tripled and there were children under 16 working full-time jobs in factories.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up in 1929, all the money at the top, not enough money in consumers' hands. And this was happening in other parts of the world. And so countries in all parts of the world were facing riots and civil distress. And they were concerned with their citizens going to communism, which included the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was protect jobs in your own country. And that was happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason it was a disadvantage to some extent was because in 1929, we were a net creditor nation.
Mm-hmm.
And other countries owed us money. And when we put tariffs on, and they put tariffs on, it made it harder for them to pay us back.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, Chuck, thank you so much for calling in. We've run out of time, and I'm really glad you called in. I think I highly recommend your book, Farewell to Fantasyland, to our readers, and you can find that at the website, farewellfantasyland.com. Chuck, again, thank you so much for calling in.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
In the year 2002, with 20 minutes warning, the Liberals introduced Bill 29. Only 3 days later, that hateful bill was passed. It offered BC workers bitter wine.
The layoffs and the closings took their toll on patient care, with loyal workers laid off and locked out. With our collective bargaining rights denied by active law, our union's very future was in doubt. But we fought back, we fought back, we fought back and we won. We fought back, we fought back, we fought back and we won. A five-year legal battle with the outcome most uncertain. With layoffs mounting, what else could we do? We educated, agitated with our friends and allies. We stood together and we saw it through. The Supreme Court was the last stop in this battle for survival, decided by three women and four men. It was on the 8th of June we heard their 6-1 decision, and things will never be the same again. We fought back, we fought back, we fought back and we won. We fought back, we fought back, we fought back and we won. To bargain, we clearly had no option but to fight. The court has finally recognized what we knew all along. Collective bargaining's a basic human right. It's cause for celebration now, but let us not forget there are many battles yet that lie before us. Now won't we all be overjoyed when Gordon Campbell's unemployed? By now he knows that he cannot ignore us. We fought back, we fought back, we fought back, we won.
Yes, folks, we need to start fighting back, that's for sure. And, Bill, we got a few minutes left here. We need some let our listeners know some important information here.
Okay, well, one way that I'm trying to fight back is I've created a Facebook group called Create a Progressive Income Tax System in Illinois. So if you're on Facebook, do a search for Create a Progressive Income Tax System in Illinois and start participating. We particularly would need, it'd be great if we could find economists who would devise such a system, or perhaps you already have. Right now, the big news is that Dan Hines is running for the nomination, the Democratic nomination for governor against Pat Quinn. And what this competition is creating is that Hines is pushing for a progressive tax system now in Illinois, which is something that a few years ago Pat Quinn was preaching.
It goes back farther than that even, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, he specifically a few years ago Pat Quinn was talking about it. It was after he was elected lieutenant governor. Okay. Mm-hmm. And but now Dan Hines, he has a plan, and his the top rate in his plan for the wealthiest people would be 7.5%.
As opposed to
right now it's a flat 3% for everybody.
Okay.
And by the time the wealthy people get all their deductions, I'm sure that several of them don't pay anything close to 3%. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, their average is 4% for the top 1% of income earners in the Illinois, who average around $2 million a year, a little over $2 million a year.
Okay.
Meanwhile, if you're in the bottom 20, averaging about $18,000 a year, you're paying 13.1% of your income.
Jeez.
In total taxes, all taxes combined. Okay, another thing I want to bring up, some interesting things. It appears that the League of Revolutionaries for a New America is making a comeback. Many years ago, back in the Peter Miller days, we used to get CDs from them, and then I used to download MP3s from their website. They were mainly based in Chicago, and I'd like to thank Damon J. Hartley of Detroit for informing me that the LRNA is back. I checked out their website, and I think they're just starting to get it going pretty well. It's nowhere near as in depth as it used to be. So I'm not really sure what's happened with the organization, but there's something that you should check out. I mean, I just like the name, the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
Sounds patriotic, actually.
Yeah, sort of superhero-ish.
Yeah, yes.
And then another thing that I've just come across, I don't know, there's, was it a year or two, a couple of years ago, some people came out with a web movie called Zeitgeist, the movie, which was really gotten into a whole lot of things, including 9/11 conspiracy theory, mm-hmm. the origins of religion, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, now this has evolved into something called the Zeitgeist Movement, which is a totally different, they're talking about a totally different economic system for the world.
How can more people find out about this?
Zeitgeist Movement, just Google it.
Okay, very good. And for any of our listeners or people on Facebook who want to know how to listen to the program, you can go to www.weft.org, and we're broadcast worldwide live every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon U.S. Central Standard Time. This has been the Illinois World Labor Hour. Stay tuned, folks, and tune in, please, next week. Thank you so much for tuning in.